Let's jump right into the critique today. This material is a profound academic white paper arguing that civilizational frameworks for planetary repair must be recursively audited to serve living reality rather than, you know, hardening into rigid self-serving doctrines.
Yeah, it is a really deep, necessary read.
Definitely. And actually, the material makes a strong case for diagnosing civilizational drift by highlighting these ancient narrative memories. But the presentation of the 12 mythic traps offers a profound diagnostic grammar, and their current sequential listing risks overwhelming the core narrative arc.
Right, because when you ask a reader to process 12 distinct, conceptually heavy philosophical metaphors back to back, I mean, you run into the issue of cognitive fatigue.
For sure.
We are talking about navigating from the Procrustes bed to Cassandra's curse to Narcissus to Babel and so on without any structural relief at all.
It's just a lot to take in all at once.
Exactly. By treating them all as sequential items on a flat list, the text inadvertently flattens the hierarchy of the ideas themselves.
Yeah, we really have to think about the reader's stamina here. To offer an analogy, this current 12-trap structure feels a bit like a museum, where the curator is rushing the visitor past 11 incredibly dense, complex historical artifacts.
Oh, without offering a place to sit down and process them?
Exactly. Just rushing them along. So by the time the visitor arrives at the Mona Lisa at the end of the hall, which in this text is the Golden Calf Trap, they are simply too exhausted to appreciate its unique brilliance.
Is there a risk that focusing solely on treating all the traps equally might overlook the unique meta-danger of the Golden Calf? Because the Golden Calf Trap absolutely requires the reader to be alert.
Right. It isn't just another flavor of civilizational drift.
No, not at all. It is the specific drift that threatens this very white paper. I mean, it is the trap of the framework itself.
Yeah, corrective capture.
Precisely. By leaving it as item number 12 on a very long list, there is a massive risk that the reader just overlooks this unique meta-danger of corrective capture completely.
Corrective capture being, well, the moment the life-saving framework becomes an idol. We see this constantly in human history, right?
Oh, all the time.
Like an environmental agency is created to protect the water supply, and 50 years later, the agency is entirely focused on protecting its own budget.
Yeah, its internal hierarchies and bureaucratic power.
Exactly. While the actual water quality continues to degrade, the framework became the golden calf. It completely forgot the living reality it was built to serve.
Right. So if we recognize that the golden calf is the ultimate existential threat to any planetary repair project, we really need to restructure this section to reflect that hierarchy.
So how do we fix that?
Well, instead of a flat list of 12, the author could group the first 11 traps into thematic clusters.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, this creates conceptual buckets that lower the cognitive load, you know, allowing the golden calf to stand completely alone as the dramatic climax of the diagnosis.
Okay, let's explore how those conceptual buckets might actually look in practice. We could take, say, the Sisyphus trap and the Hydra trap and group them together under a subheading like Traps of Ineffective Action.
That makes perfect sense. Conceptually, Sisyphus represents endless, exhausting activity without any structural release.
Rolling the boulder up the hill only for it to roll back down.
Exactly. In a policy context, that is the endless cycle of committee meetings, task forces, draft resolutions, things that never actually alter the physical reality of a crisis.
Right. And then the Hydra trap is about multiplying symptoms. You cut off one head, two grow back.
Yeah. In governance, this is treating symptoms instead of root causes. Like trying to solve traffic congestion by building wider highways.
Which we know only induces more demand and creates worse traffic.
Right. Grouping them helps the reader immediately understand that both are fundamentally about the illusion of progress.
So then we have traps dealing with information. You could group the Cassandra trap and the Oracle trap under a cluster called maybe traps of knowledge and foresight.
I mean, Cassandra is cursed to know the future but is doomed to never be believed. Think of the early climate scientists from the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, whose accurate models were just systematically ignored by institutions.
Exactly. And the Oracle trap is the inverse. It's where foresight itself becomes a self-fulfilling fatalism.
Oh, wait, like predictive policing algorithms?
Yes, exactly. The algorithm predicts crime in a specific neighborhood, so the city sends more police there.
Which results in more arrests.
Right, which feeds back into the algorithm to justify even more police presence. The foresight creates the fate.
Wow, okay. So the reader moves through these distinct, digestible clusters. They understand how action fails, they understand how knowledge fails, and then, structurally, the author can completely separate the golden calf.
Give it its own distinct major heading.
Visually and conceptually isolate it right before introducing the recursive audit.
That structural shift changes the entire reading experience, honestly. From enduring a long, repetitive list to embarking on a deliberate, suspenseful journey.
It makes a huge difference.
It really does. The golden calf becomes the ultimate threshold the reader must cross. You are essentially telling them you have survived the traps of action and the traps of knowledge, but here is the final boss.
Right, if you don't survive the trap of your own righteousness, everything else was for nothing.
Exactly.
Okay, so what I really like about this part is the audit itself. The 10-question recursive audit serves as a brilliant safeguard against idolatry, yet its practical utility feels isolated from the mythic diagnostics established earlier.
Yeah, this is a spatial issue within the architecture of the paper. Currently, the 10 audit questions, these incredibly sharp, necessary questions like, what does this obscure? And who loses voice? They are entirely sequestered at the end of the text.
Just tucked away in the appendices.
Right. The author has built this brilliant field protocol, but it's physically removed from the vivid, urgent scenarios of the mythic traps.
And appendices so often act as graveyards for operational brilliance.
They really do.
I mean, the reader has just been terrified by the diagnosis. They write about the Procrustes Fed and the Trojan Horse, and the tension is incredibly high. But they are left hanging in suspense until the very end of the document to find out if there is any way to survive them.
It forces the reader to do all the heavy lifting. They have to mentally bridge the gap between the diagnosis of civilizational drift and the active cure.
Which is asking a lot.
It is. When they finally reach the audit questions at the end, the emotional resonance of the traps has already faded.
Wait, I have to push back a bit here, though.
Sure.
If I'm reading a beautifully written, deeply academic section unpacking ancient Greek and biblical myth, and suddenly I get hit with a checklist of audit questions, doesn't that completely kill the academic elegance?
I see what you mean.
It just feels like dropping an HR compliance manual right into the middle of the Odyssey. Is there a risk we ruin the tone?
Building on that point, what if we looked at it from the perspective of narrative relief rather than an instruction manual?
Okay, how so?
Well, it's a completely valid fear. If you just copy and paste the entire 10-question list at the end of every paragraph, absolutely, it ruins the flow.
Right.
But you don't need to drop the whole list. You embed just one or two specific audit questions contextually. It doesn't read as a checklist. It reads as the immediate antidote to the tension you just built.
Oh, I see. You show the reader that these myths aren't just theoretical musings. They are actively preventable conditions if you know which tool to pull from your belt.
Precisely. Let's look at how to practically apply this with the Trojan horse trap.
Okay.
The Trojan horse represents capture hidden inside a supposed gift or a necessary reform. In a modern context, this might look like a massive corporate conglomerate offering to fund a global environmental initiative.
But doing so in a way that allows them to silently write the regulatory rules to favor their own monopolies.
Exactly.
So when the author is detailing that specific trap in the text, they shouldn't wait for the appendix to solve it. They should explicitly weave audit question number 7 directly into that paragraph, which is, what could capture this?
Yes. You write the paragraph explaining the Trojan horse, the tension builds as the reader realizes how easily a system can be captured from within, and then you immediately pivot.
Right.
You say this is exactly why a living framework must constantly ask, what could capture this? You show the reader exactly which conceptual tool disarms that specific trap in real time.
And we can do the exact same thing for the Procrustean trap. Procrustes is the myth of the innkeeper who invited guests to sleep in his iron bed.
Right, the stretching in cutting?
Yeah, if the guest was too short, he stretched them on the rack until they fit. If they were too tall, he chopped off their legs. It is the ultimate metaphor for the mutilation of living diversity by rigid, standardized measurement.
And in civilizational repair, this is a massive issue. Think about using gross domestic product as the sole metric for a nation's well-being.
It's totally a Procrustean bed.
It is. In order to make reality fit the metric of GDP, we completely ignore unpaid care work, we ignore ecological degradation, community cohesion. We chop off all the parts of living reality that just don't fit the spreadsheet.
So immediately after painting that terrifying picture of the Procrustes trap, the author pairs it with audit question number 2. What does this obscure?
Exactly. If the trap is stretching and cutting the patient to fit the bed, you stop the bleeding in the text by asking what the bed itself is hiding.
What is being left off the spreadsheet?
Right. By anchoring the specific questions directly to the myths they are meant to solve, the audit transforms from a static list at the back of the book into an integrated living practice throughout the entire text.
The reader is learning how to wield the framework at the exact same moment they are learning why the framework is necessary.
Perfectly said.
I can see what you're going for here with the execution of the framework. Let's see how we can strengthen this part, because the integration of Wu Wei introduces a compelling alternative to coercive governance, though its theoretical framing currently overshadows its practical application in high-stakes global crises.
Yeah, we are hitting a major friction point here between ancient philosophy and urgent modern pragmatism.
Definitely.
Wu Wei is the concept of non-forcing action, or minimum sufficient intervention. Philosophically, the contrast between forcing and non-forcing action is pristine in this text. But we have to put ourselves in the shoes of the audience.
Right, a global policymaker dealing with an immediate planetary threat.
Whether that is climate tipping points, artificial intelligence scaling, or resource depletion, policymakers are highly biased toward action. So when they hear non-forcing, they easily misinterpret that as dangerous passivity.
Right. They hear, let the market decide, or just sit back and watch. And that is incredibly dangerous when the stakes are planetary survival.
It really is.
The text lacks a high stakes, concrete demonstration of this concept in action, making it incredibly easy for a pragmatic reader to dismiss Wu Wei as a lovely academic theory that is just far too soft for real-world governance.
The author clearly wants to avoid the trap of imposing life coherence through domination. You know, you can't force an ecosystem to heal by putting a gun to its head.
No, obviously not.
But we need to explain how non-forcing action is actually an intensely active strategic posture.
To me, non-forcing action in global policy isn't about stepping out of the ring and letting the opponent swing at you. It is about Aikido rather than boxing.
Oh, I like that comparison.
Yeah, in boxing, you are relying on forcing action. You exert your will onto the opponent with direct, colliding momentum. You punch the threat. But in Aikido, you don't meet force with force.
Right.
You take the massive aggressive momentum of the life-blind system and you safely redirect it. You alter the geometry of the encounter so that the system neutralizes itself without you having to become a blunt instrument of violence.
That makes sense, but could the evidence also support a different conclusion, like managing a river instead of a fight?
Okay, how so?
Well, forcing action is building a massive concrete dam to stop the water entirely because you are afraid of a flood. But a dam is static.
And eventually it breaks.
Exactly. The environmental pressure builds, the concrete cracks, the dam breaks, and the resulting flood destroys everything downstream.
Right. So what is the river alternative to that?
Non-forcing action, Wu Wei, is shaping the riverbank. You guide the flow of the water. You constrain it. You direct its energy. But you do it by working with the fluid nature of the system rather than demanding the water stop being water.
I see.
Non-forcing is highly strategic, structural constraint.
That is a brilliant way to frame it. So to bring this back to the text, the author needs to anchor this philosophy in a modern scenario. Section 7 of the paper discusses AI and technology governance, specifically the Golem-Oracle coupling.
Yes. That part is fascinating.
This is the perfect place to clearly illustrate what shaping the riverbank looks like in the trenches of policy.
Yeah, and the text already outlines the danger of the Golem trap. You know, the idea of humanity building tools that escape living judgment and begin operating on their own runaway logic.
And AI scaling is the ultimate golem right now.
Absolutely. If the author maps the policy response to this, they can show the reader what a forcing action looks like in real life.
So a forcing action in AI governance would be like a rigid global top-down ban on all advanced AI development.
Right. The concrete dam.
Exactly.
And what happens when you build a dam against massive economic and technological momentum? It fails. A top-down ban creates immense pressure.
It drives the research underground into unregulated dark web shadow markets.
Or it pushes it to nation-states that refuse to sign the treaty. The attempt to force control actually guarantees that the system escapes completely.
Then the author immediately contrasts that with a non-forcing action. Instead of a ban, what if governance focused on restructuring liability laws or mandating democratic contestability loops?
Exactly. A contestability loop means that anyone affected by an algorithmic decision has a legally binding pathway to contest and reverse it.
And altering liability?
That means the creators of the algorithm are structurally on the hook for the downstream lifeblind damage their golem causes.
So you aren't banning the technology? You aren't punching the opponent? You are shaping the riverbank so that the ecosystem naturally self-corrects based on living feedback.
Yes!
If a massive tech conglomerate is suddenly legally liable for the psychological damage their algorithm inflicts on teenagers, well, their internal incentives completely shift.
They will frantically regulate themselves.
Right. They will build the leash for their own golem because their survival depends on it.
By grounding this ancient concept of Wu Wei in the hyper-modern, highly technical context of AI liability and algorithmic contestability, you completely shatter the illusion that non-forcing action is passive surrender.
You really do.
You prove to the pragmatic policymaker that it is, in fact, the most sophisticated, durable form of planetary governance available. It takes a deeply philosophical section, strips away the academic abstraction, and gives it actual teeth.
It bridges the gap perfectly between a biology of love and the harsh, complex realities of global policy design. All right, let's briefly recap our three main actionable takeaways for maximizing the impact of this piece.
Sounds good.
Buckets. This builds narrative suspense and allows the golden calf trap to stand alone as the ultimate climax of the section.
Number two, rescue the recursive audit from the appendix. Weave those specific questions directly into the discussions of the mythic traps. This provides immediate narrative relief to the reader and bridges the gap between the diagnosis of the illness and the application of the cure.
And number three, ground the philosophy of non-forcing action in a concrete, high-stakes modern governance scenario, like AI regulation. Show, don't just tell, the pragmatic reader how shaping the riverbank is a more viable strategy than building a dam.
I just want to add, the depth of this work is incredible, and it is so deeply necessary in today's climate. The author has built something really profound here.
They absolutely have. We invite you to implement these revisions and submit your work back in for a future critique.